This is Kathleen Stevenson for the Radio Zine. I'm speaking with Dan Rolfe, who is a law professor at Lewis and Clark Law School, specializing in environmental issues. Dan Rolfe teaches wildlife law, environmental litigation, and other courses in the law school's Environmental and Natural Resources program. He also directs the Pacific Environmental Advocacy Center. Dan, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much.
On Thursday, President Obama announced his decision to impose a six-month pause on offshore oil leasing. You say that despite the announcement of a moratorium on offshore oil drilling, the federal regulators are still granting such permits. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Actually, it's not entirely clear what's happening right now. Last week, President Obama and the Secretary of Interior announced that the federal government would grant no new authorizations for drilling while the spill is ongoing. However, the federal government fairly narrowly interpreted that moratorium to exclude some new drilling at existing well sites. And so the Department of Interior was indeed still issuing some new permits for drilling at existing well sites. And on Thursday last week, President Obama, of course, announced that he was extending the moratorium on new drilling for 6 months, as well as including offshore drilling off the coast of Alaska and off the eastern seaboard. Now, it's not entirely clear from that announcement whether or not the president now intends to include all new drilling in that moratorium. I think there's a clear exception for some types of new drilling. For example, obviously, there needs to be another well drilled at the Deepwater Horizon site. That may be the only way we will end up stopping the oil, so that new drilling clearly needs to take place. It might be possible that other drilling may need to take place just to keep existing wells from becoming unstable. So those, of course, would be exceptions. However, it's not clear at this point whether or not the announced moratorium includes all new drilling. This sort of ambiguity actually points to one piece of a very large puzzle in federal law that presents a number of problems with adequately regulating oil and gas drilling. Right now, the federal government feels that it is bound by a 30-day time limit that when an oil company requests a permit to drill, federal law requires that the Minerals Management Service make a decision within 30 days. And in the past, that's what the Secretary of Interior has cited in saying that for existing well sites, the federal government really doesn't have discretion to say no. Now, I think there may be ways to interpret the law to allow the federal government to say no to all new drilling except for emergency needs. But it's not yet clear whether the current moratorium that was imposed last week really does go that far. It's kind of been surprising that we've seen very little on these moratoria actually in writing. We've just sort of heard that in press conferences.
My reaction, and I think a lot of people's reaction, would be, what do you mean the federal government can't make this rule? That they have to consult with the Minerals Management Service? Or explain that a little bit more.
Sure. The Minerals Management Service is an agency within the United States Department of Interior. So Minerals Management Service is part of the federal government, of course. But federal agencies are bound by federal statutes. So the law that is passed by Congress binds the discretion of federal agencies. And so the Minerals Management Service has said that according to federal law, in some cases, it does not have the authority to say no to drilling permits. So I think there may be ways to interpret federal law to allow for a complete moratorium, or the federal government could simply say, well, we declined to issue this permit, and if you really want to file a legal challenge against the federal government during the worst oil spill in American history, you know, go ahead. I think oil companies may generally decline that invitation anyway. So I think as a practical matter, the federal government certainly would have the authority, should it choose to exercise it, to disallow all new drilling over a period of time.
And so what do you think about Obama's statement and what it actually prohibits and what it should prohibit?
Well, I hope the president meant to include a moratorium on all new offshore oil and gas leasing until we sort out many of the inadequacies in the way we have both implementing existing regulations governing oil and gas exploration and development, and also sorted out those regulations themselves, and made a careful assessment as to whether or not the existing rules and laws that we apply to offshore oil and gas exploration and development are in fact adequate to protect the environment. Not only that, of course, I think we have to take a close look at whether we have the capability to both manage and respond to a significant spill. And unfortunately, I think the catastrophe with the Deepwater Horizon blowout right now is demonstrating that we certainly don't have that capacity. So I would also hope that before we resume offshore oil and gas exploration, that we would take a close look at our capacity to respond to spills.
When oil companies are issued permits, do they have to go through some kind of process? Is there an assessment that's done? How does that happen generally?
There's a federal law called the National Environmental Policy Act that requires federal agencies to assess the environmental impacts of their actions prior to taking those actions. Known by its acronym, statute is called NEPA. For offshore oil and gas leasing and exploration and development, there are sort of levels of federal agency activity that start sort of at the broad exploration and leasing scale and go down to the individual exploration and development scale. What we have learned that in dealing with kind of the last tier of development, which is specifically exploring and beginning to drill on individual sites, the Minerals Management Service pretty routinely violated the National Environmental Policy Act by exempting itself, essentially, from the environmental impact assessment requirements of NEPA. Interestingly, the Minerals Management Service continued to issue additional exemptions from NEPA even after the blowout occurred in late April. Minerals Management Service has issued at least 20 exceptions from the environmental impacts assessment requirements of NEPA, basically saying there's no possibility of a significant impact on the environment, so therefore we don't need to do any more environmental impact assessment. And hopefully, if the President and the Secretary of Interior are now serious about a moratorium, that moratorium will also include granting any further exemptions to the environmental impact assessment requirements of NEPA. I think the Minerals Management Service needs to take a very close look at its regulations that interpret the requirements, the environmental impact assessment requirements of NEPA, and reassess those to ensure that prior to specific exploration activities, as we saw with Deepwater Horizon, that there would be a full environmental impact analysis as well as public participation.
I'm speaking with Dan Rolfe. He is a law professor at Lewis and Clark Law School, and we're talking about some of the legal issues involved in the BP oil spill. Now, I read that when Interior Secretary Ken Salazar was asked about the continued issuing of permits and waivers, he explained that his agency had no intention of stopping all new oil and gas production in the Gulf. Is there something you can fill us in about what that means and how that will play into this whole thing?
Again, getting past some of the ambiguity about the 6-month moratorium on offshore exploration and production in United States waters, I think what both the President and Secretary Salazar referred to was that they did not anticipate that the United States would no longer rely on additional sources of oil and gas from offshore wells. I think that's simply a reflection of the fact that the United States uses over 7.1 billion barrels of oil per year, and United States domestic production of oil has declined from its high in 1972 of 3.5 billion, about half of what we now use, to now only about 2 billion barrels of oil per year, which is less than a third of what this country uses. And so I think there is a recognition by the government that we cannot simply, at this stage, say we will have no more oil and gas production from offshore. Of course, oil companies go to where the oil is, and the easily accessible reserves and most of the onshore reserves have been explored and are being or have been exploited. And by far the largest reserves of oil and gas in the United States are located offshore, many of those in the Gulf of Mexico. So I think if we continue with our current economy, our current use of energy, we have virtually no alternative but to continue to exploit offshore oil and gas resources. Now, hopefully, we will completely revamp regulations for accessing those sorts of resources and both comply with existing law and improve our existing law to make that exploration and production more environmentally sound. However, I think, you know, we all bear some responsibility in this spill, in the sense that we wouldn't be going after this risky exploration and production if we didn't use a tremendous amount of oil in our everyday lives. And so I think if we're really thinking about a long-term solution to the environmental risks posed by offshore oil and gas development, we really kind of need to take a look within and say, how can we develop energy resources? How can we develop fuels? How can we develop ways to get around where we don't have to go after oil under the sea? And so, you know, if anything good were to come out of this terrible catastrophe that's unfolding in the Gulf, I think it would be a better resolve on the part of Congress, but also I think on the part of all of us, to say we need to be serious about looking beyond oil.
So the demand is driving the wells, so to speak, the demand for this product.
Oh, of course. When companies can make $30 billion in profits per year producing oil, and people will buy and in fact depend on practically limitless supplies of that resource, there will always be tremendous pressure to get that resource. And unfortunately, when humans get involved, you will always see failures to implement safeguards, failures to follow law, some of the pretty egregious coziness that has come out between regulators and the oil and gas companies. Last week, another Inspector General report was released, for example, that showed an incredibly tight relationship and effectively a revolving door relationship between federal regulators and the Minerals Management Service office in Louisiana that was responsible for offshore oil and gas leasing and exploration, and the oil companies themselves. The Minerals Management Service officials were accepting gifts from oil companies. In some cases, MMS officials were inspecting oil rigs run by companies that they were actively applying for a job from. That sort of activity, unfortunately, historically, has taken place. There was a scandal a couple of years ago where Minerals Management Service officials were literally having sex with and doing drugs with oil company officials. And at that time, you know, the then Secretary of Interior, Dirk Kempthorne, vowed that he would reform the agency. And unfortunately, we see the results of that, and they weren't very successful. You know, I think we have to, again, double our resolve to try to get rid of revolving doors between regulators and the companies they regulate. We have to pay more attention to our elected leaders. Congress has given the oil and gas companies literally billions of dollars over the years, even while those companies make billions and billions of dollars in profit. And not a lot of people pay attention to that. And so, you know, that's another thing I think we need to do is hold leaders accountable in Congress to say, it's up to you to try to improve our energy policy so we don't need to explore in these dangerous areas for oil and gas. But it's also up to you to regulate those companies sufficiently to the extent that we do.
I read that the lawsuits that have started to be filed against BP, I guess there are at least 100 lawsuits after the oil spill, that BP is trying to put all the cases in the hands of a single federal judge in Houston named Lynn Hughes, who has a connection with BP and works with BP and other oil companies. Have you heard anything about this?
Yes, I believe I read a similar account.
And what needs to happen to prevent that from happening? That seems like an ethical violation.
Well, of course, there are ways that the parties in those cases can attempt to disqualify a judge or move venue to another court if indeed there are clear indications that a judge may not be completely impartial. And I imagine that there will be quite a few challenges about venue, i.e., you know, the place, the court that will hear those particular cases. But again, I think if we look to some legal reforms, then we may not have to rely as much on the court system for victims or for economic victims or even, you know, personal victims of an oil spill to gain compensation. Right now, for example, under federal law, BP is actually on the hook only for $75 million in economic damages. That is not much more than the equivalent of you and I going out to buy a latte one afternoon. $75 million to BP is very, very little money. And unfortunately, $75 million is also very little money when we tally up all the economic damage that will result from this spill. Now, to have that sort of trivial amount of money as the cap in federal law on economic damages that an oil company would be liable for in a spill, in my view, is not very sound public policy. And there have already been debates in Congress about substantially raising that cap or potentially eliminating it altogether. And I think that's a very legitimate issue to discuss. And I think if we undertook some of those legal reforms, there would be less of a need for people to rely on the court system to try to get compensation for those sorts of economic damages. I also think that the federal government should and could well use all of the legal tools at its disposal to seek both criminal and civil penalties from oil companies involved in these sorts of accidents. And I think there are a number of statutes where BP could be liable for extensive amounts of money for penalties, for both civil and criminal penalties, as a result of its conduct that's resulted in this spill.
Let's talk about that for a minute, because in my job I hear a lot of a public response, and many people are very, very angry and would say, you know, why aren't the executives responsible for BP being arrested for various violations, including the workers who were killed and the destruction of the environment and the threat to all these communities? How do you respond, or how do you talk to that?
Well, I think those are very legitimate concerns that BP, in this instance, as well as Halliburton and some of the other companies involved in this tragic set of circumstances, may well have committed both civil and criminal violations. I think something like that, however, I certainly understand people's concern and frustration at the moment, and I really sympathize with that. However, in this type of circumstance, the facts are very complex. The facts can be very unclear, at least initially. And so the worst thing, I think, for a federal prosecutor to do would be to act very quickly before a good case can be put together. You know, I have no doubt that there are attorneys working very hard right now at the U.S. Department of Justice looking to put many civil and criminal claims together against companies and potentially even individuals that may be culpable for this sort of disaster. And I think it will be very interesting to see how that plays out over time. But just the nature of the criminal and civil processes is that you really have to put together a very careful case before you, you know, take the step of arresting people or charging people. So I have very little doubt that we will see criminal and civil charges arising out of this tragedy. However, the companies and individuals that may in fact be charged, they're not really going anywhere. So I don't see, there's not much of a flight risk or anything like that. We know who these people are and these companies are and where they are. So as federal investigators and attorneys complete their work, I'm sure we'll see those sorts of charges.
I'm speaking with Dan Rolfe. He is a law professor at Lewis and Clark Law School, and we're talking about some of the legal issues involved in the BP oil spill. Dan Rolfe, we only have a few minutes left, but I wonder if you could sort of summarize maybe what you see from a legal perspective as the best case scenario and the worst case scenario in this situation.
Well, I think we really have to think about both a law and policy perspective. Maybe the best case scenario is both the federal government and the American people will realize that very strict adherence to existing law for all these sorts of dangerous development activities, especially related to offshore oil and gas leasing, that we must be very careful to follow the letter of all environmental laws that try to protect against the sort of situation we're seeing unfolding now. I think another best case scenario would be that Congress decides to take a close look at revamping and overhauling some of the laws that govern offshore oil and gas leasing, removing some of the arbitrarily short time frames, perhaps setting some areas off limits permanently to oil and gas leasing in particularly crucial areas. There are areas in Alaska that are very productive fisheries, and a spill of this magnitude there would be tremendously disastrous. So I think that's a legal and policy issue we have to take a close look at. I think we also need to consider, should we continue to throw billions of dollars of federal tax subsidies at oil companies when they're making billions of dollars and unfortunately not investing as well as they should in safety and response requirements. So I think all of those things, if we got serious as a result of this spill and took a look at that and overhauled those systems, I think that would be a best case scenario. I think a worst case scenario is more of the same. Skirting environmental laws, encouraging or turning away from cozy behavior between regulators and the industry, and it'll just be a matter of time before we see another disaster just like this.
And is there anything else that you think is important to say that we haven't touched on in this interview about some of the legal issues involved in this situation?
Well, a couple of things. I think we haven't really touched a great deal on the economics of the situation, but if you look economically at this sort of activity, what we're doing is we're putting billions of dollars of Americans' money, of American taxpayers' money, in the pocket of oil and gas companies, and we're also not taking advantage of billions of dollars of economic activity that we could generate if we got a lot more serious about developing alternative, non-carbon-based, non-hydrocarbon-based energy sources. So if we moved away from oil and started to look toward alternative sources of fuel and energy. China right now, unfortunately, is one of the world leaders in solar energy and wind energy. There is an electric car that's beginning to be marketed in the United States the car is a Japanese car. And I think if this country wants to get more serious about protecting the environment, improving our economy, improving our, indeed our national security, it's pretty clear, I think, that looking to alternatives to oil and gas is a very productive way to go. And so President Obama has, in fact, made that link already and has said, you know, this sort of tragedy should galvanize us to think more in a more forward fashion about America's energy future. And, you know, if anything good does come out of this terrible tragedy, I think it would be going toward a more secure energy future that has many fewer environmental risks, that increases rather than continually decreases American national security, and that also provides economic opportunity, particularly in this sort of tough economy. So I think looking to a different energy future rather than just continuing to pump gas into our cars, I think that's something that's pretty crucial for us to think about.
Dan Rolf, professor of law at Lewis and Clark Law School in environmental issues, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO.